Welcome to Arts Waves, the Monday edition of Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Tony Tacconi, Artistic Director of Berkeley Rep in Berkeley. Tony Tacconi has also directed several shows over the years. And this is how many seasons now?
Well, I think this is going to be my 18th season as Artistic Director.
Before we went on the air, and this is where I want to start, and we're going to talk about the past season and the upcoming season, and also I want to talk about the changes made in the Thrust stage, which will be incorporated through the coming fall, and then next January it's scheduled to reopen. How do you achieve balance, gender balance, with playwrights, with directors, racial balance? How do you make sure at Berkeley Rep that it all works?
Well, one of the goals of any season is to create as eclectic a season as possible. So that is good, because that right away you're looking at an inclusive agenda, both the surprise that you're trying to sustain and create is married to a diverse goal. So right there, you're looking at all kinds of plays that are not the same. And that's not just theatrically, but it tends to work with personnel. And obviously we're all trying to get work in which represents as big a swath of the American experience as possible. The American experience, if nothing, it is diversified. We're talking about class, race, issues, and so trying to get plays that reflect that is a top goal. It helps to have a diverse staff, because if the voices on staff are diverse, then it becomes a more natural inclination to think in certain ways. If the culture of the organization is inclusive, then you will be thinking in that way already. So, you know, certainly we've made a big effort over the years to include work from different communities in the Bay Area, obviously, you know, racially and gender-wise. I have to say it's always a challenge, because you're also trying to get the best work possible, and sometimes those things don't completely line up. You know, sometimes you're top-heavy with a certain kind of work, and you get a little daunted. But you can almost guarantee that the following season will rectify that issue. But then it has its own issues, so every season is in some ways a reaction to the last year.
And this would involve both playwrights and directors. I mean, how do you maneuver to make sure that the playwright, the director, and even the cast are diverse in any given season when you're talking about just a handful of plays?
Probably the single biggest change in the process at Berkeley Rep under my leadership has been the primacy of the writer. I would say that one of the things that Sharon was so great at was making directors prominent voices at the theater. And I think when my turn came to the plate, I decided that as much as I love that aesthetic, being a director myself, I also felt like the writer, especially if we're going to embark, as we have, on this diet of new work, that the writer had to assume a more prominent role as an animating voice at the theater. So I think for us now, it actually starts with the writers and moves quickly into the directors and the creative teams, which the directors then bring on board. You know, obviously, writers are going to predominantly write from their own background, their own set of interests. If you have people of color who are writing plays for you, they're going to be more open to writing plays that deal with those issues than perhaps other folks are. So it's a kind of a symbiotic kind of a relationship.
How many plays in any given season are you contemplating, say, in November, knowing that you'll be announcing in February or March?
I would say by November, you've got to have a pretty good shape, because things fall apart. I would say by November, you've got to have 20 ideas that are going to get down to 10. But by November, you've also picked three. I've picked three, and I've got two more that I'm really interested in. But having said that, the biggest single challenge of any season is that things fall apart, things that you had locked in. And the problem, of course, is that, you know, that has to do more or less with schedules. It's a myriad of things, but schedules, opportunities, people can't make commitments in time that you need them to make a commitment by. Because, you know, when you say November, I'm asking for somebody to commit 2 years out sometimes. If we're talking about the following, right. You know, the spring and a half. So it's almost 18 months, 2 years out. That's a long time for people to commit when they're up for movies and TV shows and all kinds of other opportunities. So you can't line up as many people as you would like to be able to line up, you know, like in advance. But it obviously helps in terms of selling the plays that we have as much advance word as possible. So there's always a challenge every single year between balancing when we want to announce and the commitments we can get to make the announcement.
On top of all of the other issues, you have the fact that the entire season could hinge on one play and that play could disappear.
You tend to build seasons around one or two plays. The desire for what those plays are happens usually actually fairly early. Because you know that if I do this production, which includes like 30 elephants, then I'm going to need to make a commitment to that. It's going to limit what else I can do. It's very hard to add really big shows once you've picked those big shows. So we tend to pick the big shows first and go like, okay, we're building our season around that. One of the reasons why we established the Ground Floor, which is our development program for plays, is that it's great if I can commission a play, put it in the Ground Floor, see its maturation in front of my eyes and go, we're doing that. And we're doing that a year and a half from now. If I can identify two of those a year, it makes the planning process much, much easier.
You always have a fallback.
It's not just a fallback. I have a spine. I've commissioned this person. I've commissioned Terrell McCraney or Tony Kushner or so on. They're in. Once you commission a play, you own the rights. You have the right of first refusal. And if it's good, you're like, yeah. What you want, ideally, is for everybody to invest. You want the playwright, the director, the staff. When the staff gets to see a play early in the process, they start getting really excited. When the board can get a little whiff of what's going on, they get excited. It's a buy-in thing. The plays that we bring in from the outside are usually the last ones picked because as exciting as they are, they don't quite have the same level of investment.
Tony Taccone, let's talk a little bit about the past season. At some point, you were going to start refurbishing the Thrust earlier, but it got pushed back. That meant you had other shows to do, right?
Have you ever renovated your house, Richard?
Yes.
In Berkeley? Have you ever tried that? You try to go through the planning commission on that one. You know, you can't change a planter without 18 people weighing in. And I will go on record as saying that. It actually didn't come as a surprise to us what the calendar was on this. I mean, we had known that the Thrust was going to be out of commission for about 6 months. It starts this June. It goes through next December. Obviously, we folded the summer into that, so it was the least onerous invasion of our regular season planning. So we're actually only going to miss one show next season in the Thrust. It'll affect our special events and all that. So we are producing in the Osher Theater for the first time in a regular season run show, Pirates of Penzance. What's great about that, and I think what's interesting is that there is a, I'm sure you've noticed, there's a movement in the American theater going on about environmental work. Now, when I was a young man, which is back in the Stone Age, there was a similar movement. Environmental work was very popular. We did a road at the Eureka Theater where there were like 60 seats and the rest of the audience like milled around. It's called Promenade in England. But environmental shows were very popular and really exciting. And so I'm kind of really juiced to be going back to a form that, you know, I haven't been able to really flex my muscles with a little bit, you know, since that time period. So Pirates of Penzance is coming. It's being done by the Hypocrites, which is a company from Chicago. They've done it a bunch around the United States, and they do these kind of what I would call this sort of anti-musical musical. It uses all the music from the show, but it's staged in a very, very exciting and kind of raw way. You know, the water is represented by like a kiddie pool. It's really fun. A portion of the audience will be able to sit, and a portion will stand and mill around amongst the actors. They love that. The Hypocrites is known as a company. They didn't want to do their show on the Thrust. They want to do it in a more environmentally surprising space. And so when we had the opportunity to do that, it was like, this is a perfect match.
That's sort of what they mean by a black box, that you could just remove everything.
Yeah. A black box is basically an open space where the seating is flexible and you can arrange it in any kind of way you like. The difference between environmental theater is that there is usually a significant portion of the audience that literally moves around in the space. It's not just they're seating on all four sides or they're seating in threes. It's like you get to move around. You're encouraged to move around with the actors, and you can shift your position and you can touch the actors. This is a zoo where you actually get to touch the animals. So it's kind of fun that way.
Let's go back and talk a little about the last season. An audience with Meow Meow, at my end, I loved her. I wasn't 100% thrilled with the show itself, but she was awesome.
She is an awesome performer, and I think that the issue with the show, from my mind, is that Meow Meow is a kind of classically subversive performer. And I think that the conceit that we came up with was that the show is going to Broadway, which it still intends to do, you know, might not have been the right frame for it. I felt like it kind of put a layer on top of the show that I'm not sure it needed. And so I think when we recalibrate it, it'll probably lose that frame. But I think she's an amazing performer. She's phenomenal with the audience. She's a brilliant singer. She's a great comic actress. So on all those levels, I was really happy with it.
And Party People, of course, was pretty much sold out. I mean, you had all of these Black Panthers coming to the show.
Well, Party People was one of those rare shows where the marriage of the community and the history of the community with the play was so deep that the audience brought with it a kind of wellspring of their own experience that they were, if not reliving, they were certainly invited to re-examine their own past. And many people did just that. I think it was extremely powerful for many people. And the cast had a pretty profound experience because not just Panthers came, but there were a lot of us who were, you know, in some aspect of the movement. Certainly Berkeley, California, my God, here we are. It's one of the reasons I wanted to do the show is because, you know, obviously this is the birth of the free speech movement, and there were certainly a lot of radicals here of every ethnic background and persuasion. And also, you know, a lot of people were inspired to become activists in whatever field that they went into. I mean, I bet you could trace your own, you know, aspirations to get into the field that you're in because of some way the 60s affected you. And that legacy, when you see that in front of you as an audience member, when you go to a play and there's something about the play that actually catalyzes your own history in a way that feels very immediate, it's a very passionate experience for people. And so I would say that would most accurately describe the experience of our audience. It was a passionate event, both on stage and in the audience. And I think it was palpable. I mean, the show extended for 2 weeks, and it did fantastically well in terms of the kind of energy that was in the space.
You're talking about two shows that kind of anchor it. It seemed to me, looking at the past season, that would be Head of Passes and Party People. Is that correct?
You know, the thing about that is it's easy to make sort of broad statements about that. But what's interesting, you know, Richard, is that, you know, people have really different experiences to different plays. I mean, you know, we had people who came to X's and O's who had deep experiences because of their own personal background with sports and with football and playing the game. Every single play that we do, every single play has people who champion the play and people who think that is just about the worst thing you've ever done. And they tell me that regularly on both sides, but there you go.
Then there was also Red Hot Patriot, and my only complaint about the show was too short. I wanted to see more.
Well, you know, I think that's a fair assessment. I mean, because I feel like, honestly, the Red Hot Patriot, which I think Kathleen Turner was fantastic in it, and I don't think we kind of learned enough about Molly Ivins. And in that sense, it's really not a play. It's a presentation of a character in a moment. And I think it did an excellent job of bringing her back to life, if you will, and presenting her legacy as a journalist, as a social critic. I don't think you got too much nuance about her psychology. And like I said, in that sense, it really wasn't a play. I have criticized myself about whether or not we should have done that as a special event. Because as a special event, you don't bring the same expectations. But as a slot in the season, I think you do. And I think that suffered from, I think, a little bit of the three-dimensionality of what her background was all about.
The other show that we haven't mentioned yet is Tartuffe, which I just blown away. Particularly the set was just awesome, but the whole thing is just...
You know, Tartuffe, for me, and I know there were some people, it was somewhat controversial because of the subject matter. For me, the artistry of that production of Tartuffe was spectacular. The continuing and sustained beauty of the images, which, as you mentioned, in this brilliant architectural setting, I mean, Dominique, the director, was trained as an architect, and you can see that in his visual constructions. And the combination of bawdiness and the brutality, the comedy right next to the tragedy of it, I think it was an illuminating production of a Tartuffe. There are people who come and say, well, it's not usually done that way. And I would say, yeah. I take risks in that regard. I mean, I don't even think about how things were done before. I mean, I'm aware of things being done in a certain way, but my feeling is, how can I keep us all excited and engaged? That's my number one thing.
You're listening to an interview with Tony Taccone, artistic director of Berkeley Rep. One Man, Two Governors is playing at Berkeley Rep through June 21st. I'm Richard Walensky on Arts Waves. One Man, Two Governors was on Broadway, big success. Is this pretty much similar production?
No and yes. The play is based on Goldoni's famous Servant of Two Masters. It is a raucous, wild comic ride, just as it was in London, where it first appeared at the National, because it transferred from the National to New York. I think the central difference is that the main character in the English version of the play was a very rotund man. And we have gone the opposite way. We've cast a beanpole. Because the central idea is that he's starving. And we cast the beanpole because we found Dan Donahue, who's a brilliant comic actor. And so we wrote to the playwright and said, we cast a beanpole. He said, good, you need to change these five lines. And he did. So he wrote to us and adapted the script for that. I would say it's the same spirit. Absolutely, it's a wild ribald farce, and it's really, really fun, and it's hugely entertaining, and it's got the same music. I would say, though, because it's a new cast, and, you know, like a director who has his own takes, I think it's a little bit of a different viewpoint on the show.
The last show of the season, though, was just recently announced. Notes from the Field, Doing Time in Education, Anna Deavere Smith, one-woman show. Did she approach you? Did you approach her? How did that come about?
She approached us. Anna's an old friend, a colleague. We've done three of her shows here. She's a person who I have enormous respect for, both as an artist and as a thinker. She's one of those rare people who can talk to many, many different kinds of people in this culture and with equal ease, and she has this facility that people feel comfortable talking to her about deep and controversial topics. This particular show is about the pipeline between the educational system and our prisons, and it's a subject that's actually attained a lot of attention lately in the news. In fact, the president came out a couple of weeks ago and talking about this very issue. Anna was invited to give a keynote address at the Kennedy Center in front of the heads of state, and she spoke a lot about this topic. So this is the result of her research and field work for the last 2 years. She's been interviewing people around the country, a lot of who are in California, both prominent people in the prison system and obviously people who have had experience trying to understand what the failures of the educational system have been and how they've led to a certain kind of patterning of failure. The radical thing about this show is that there's two acts. The first act is her performance. The second act is literally going to happen in the audience, where we're breaking the audience out into groups of like 20 people all over the entire campus at Berkeley Rep here, and we're going to gather people's ideas and thoughts about what they've just seen and bring them back together in the theater at the conclusion of the second act. It's going to be an experiment. It's an experiment in actually trying to create a deeper and more active dialogue instead of action plans, not just kind of like going to a show, you watch it perform in a passive way, you think, oh, that's kind of cool, and you go home. This is literally a designed event that is trying to stimulate a different kind of activism. We'll see how it goes.
Well, Tony Taccone, the first show of next season is a musical version of the film Amelie. Why this, and how does it speak to, say, the Berkeley audience?
Amelie is one of my favorite movies of all time. I mean, it is, for those people who are fans, it's got kind of a cultish following. It's a very stylized romance. It's got a heart of relentless innocence. It's about a girl who comes from a rather challenging background psychologically, parents who either weren't there for her or didn't have the tools to love her. She moves as an adult to Paris. It's a simple story. It's a story of a girl finding love and her very, very fantastical way of doing that. The genius of the film is the stylization of it, the actual craft of it. We were talking earlier about Tartuffe. The single most impressive and obvious feature of Tartuffe, the one that we just did, was its style. It had a unique authorial voice that was so visible in the performances, in the staging, in the look, the feel. The sensorial experience of that thing was unique, and you walk in there and went, that is coming from a different perspective. And Amelie has that same challenge. Now, the real challenge will be, obviously, this is a musical, and the film was not a musical. What I like about that is that the musical has its own formal style, and so trying to create a new style that can both, be as effective as the film was in relating what it's trying to express, and also in the absolutely joyous and fanciful way it does it. That's our challenge, and I think we're well on our way. The music is really pretty great. I was just at a workshop of it last month, and it's very winning. How does it relate to the Berkeley audience? Well, last I checked, the Berkeley audience still had the capacity to fall in love, although that's sometimes up for grabs. But I will say that that's a theme that usually is still relevant for people.
How did you find out about this?
They called us. The director is a woman named Pam McKinnon, who is a fantastic director. Craig Lucas is a guy who's written many plays that we've done in the past. He's the book writer. The guys who are writing the music are from a well-known band. So we felt the combination of creative talents was really impressive, and so I felt very excited about it.
Disgraced by Ayad Akbar won the Pulitzer in 2013. It's about cultural assimilation at a dinner party.
It's about a guy who's an aspiring lawyer slash broker in a big firm in New York who's actually hidden his ethnicity from his employers because he feels it would be too politicized and too controversial. If it comes out that he's from that part of the world, then people will start making judgments and assumptions about who he actually is and not trust him enough. So his wife, who is white and a liberal and an artist, encourages him to get involved with his nephew, who is seeing this imam and who needs some help. And against his better judgment, he ends up helping this kid. It gets out in the paper, and his career comes on the line. And it causes this volcanic fracture in his family, and in particular, they're two really good friends, an interracial couple, a Jewish guy and a black woman. And they have this dinner party where literally all hell breaks loose. And it's a phenomenal scene. It's one of the great scenes, certainly the last few years in my mind. And a range of topics are covered that I won't spoil. It's a very provocative play, and I know our audience is going to really love this play. When is the truth of your identity an advantage and a limitation? How do you present yourself to the world? You're trying to succeed in a culture where you're trying to assimilate, where you're not the dominant voice, where you're not empowered. How does the voice of an oppressed person, make it through the landmines of a culture that is run by people who are not like you? That's complicated.
Tony Taccone, now we come up on Aubergine by Julia Cho. Now, that's going to be at The Thrust. What happens if The Thrust isn't ready, or is that
that's
something...
That's never going to happen, Richard, and you should never mention that in my... I have been, actually, you're raising a kind of funny question, because I've asked that question 85 times at staff meetings, and they keep reassuring me, it's not going to happen, it's not going to happen, it's not going to happen. And so, I think they are super aware. We've given ourselves a lot of extra time to get on the project. In fact, we've done all the legwork on it, so we kind of know what the problems are. We opened up the walls in our theater. There's a lot of extremely old wiring that all of it has to be replaced. You asked what that project is. It's about upgrading the thrust. I mean, it's built in 81. This isn't just 81 where a couple of people are banging around in a house, you know, for like 35 years. This is a facility that gets used every single day by hundreds and hundreds of people. The seats have to be replaced. The sound system has to be replaced. The wiring system has to be replaced. Now that we're, you know, in the actual 21st century, the technology's changed a lot, and so we have got to keep up with that. And we've been doing that with patchwork stuff. But we have to go in there and kind of scrape it down and rebuild it back up.
As someone with hearing issues, I'm finding if I'm on the side, it's very difficult to hear the dialogue.
Well, this is going to address that. We're putting in a Constellation sound system, which is the Meyer. I don't know if you know John Helen Meyer. They're brilliant sound developers and sound engineers, and they have been so important in instrumental voices in creating revolutionary new experiences in sound. I mean, from Olivetto's, I don't know if you've ever been there, but they put in this system. I was just there the other day. The space is now mic'd, actually. So they are trying to shed a lot of the ambient sound from other conversations. So the tables can be in close proximity to each other, but you can easily hear the person who you're talking across from. It's a fantastic thing. They built the new system that's in Symphony Hall in their new space. They are saints. Honestly, John Helen Meyer are saints. They should be canonized right now. I should write a letter to the Pope, who this Pope might be open to it. But they're brilliant people. They've been huge patrons of ours. They're spectacular in their generosity. And so we're going to be outfitting the entire thrust stage with this new system, which will hopefully, you know, really address the very issues that you just brought up.
What is Aubergine and what's it about? It's a world premiere.
Yeah, Aubergine is a beautiful play written by a Korean-American writer, Julia Cho. It's about a Korean family. The father is dying, and his son, who he's never gotten along with, has trying to figure out how to take care of his dad. That's a problem that many of us have been grappling with in our advancing age. So the son, who is a chef, whose life choices have never been respected by his dad, has to face trying to reconcile his relationship with his father, who was in a coma. So in order to do that, he actually makes contact with the father's brother in Korea, who comes to the States, and together this magnificent, magical meal is prepared. But it's really about redemption. It's really about children reconciling with their parents, both the limitations and the possibilities of that. That's what it's about. And it's a beautiful play. Julia is a wonderful writer. She's been writing for television a lot of late. She's had many, many stage plays that were done. But this is a kind of like return to her for the stage. So I feel really great about winning her back towards the stage.
Macbeth, directed by Daniel Sullivan.
Daniel Sullivan, who is a tremendous director. I don't know if you've ever seen any of his work in New York. He's been working in New York for a lot of years now. He used to be the artistic director of Seattle Rep. The great thing about Shakespeare is that you can kind of throw the kitchen sink at him, and he still manages to survive. You know, Macbeth is a very challenging play. I think it's going to take a director like Dan to kind of wrestle it into clarity. I did a production of Macbeth here years ago where I felt like the production values I thought were really, really good, but I don't think the production ultimately worked. There were some blind spots I had in the show. You've got those monologues, you know, that he has. There's six of them, I think. The show kind of lands on those and your believability as to whether or not this guy's really going there, you know, because it ends up being about a kind of psychosis. You know, this guy who murders a king in a fit of ambition, encouraged by his wife, ends up trying to validate his actions by committing more murders. Not a good choice. but that watching him go through that process and watching her go through that process, you know, is the heart of the show. And then to top it off, you got to figure out the witches. And then you got to figure out what the hell the porter's saying. So those are real challenges. But Dan he's a phenomenal storyteller. He's a brilliant, brilliant storyteller. I mean, his ability to like reveal the essence and the nuance of any given story is second to none. And so I'm very excited to have him come and work on the play with us. And We don't do Shakespeare, you know, a lot because it's done a lot, and I feel like when we do it, we need to make a contribution. I think this will be a contribution.
Treasure Island, The Return of Mary Zimmerman. This is a co-production with Looking Glass Theater.
Mary works at Looking Glass. She's a founding member of that company in Chicago, and so much of the work that she does originates there, or the Goodman Theater in Chicago, where she's also on staff. Mary's, you know, one of the artists who I believe she knows she has a second home here. She's very proud of that. Whenever she does a show, she calls us right away, and we've originated shows with her as well. You know, she's just got a gorgeous voice. Her way into the material. Somebody said about her work, I think Frank Galati, who's a fellow director and a colleague of Mary's, who was actually her teacher at Northwestern, said about her work that it's based on healing, that she believes in the theater as a place of healing. And I think that that's a great way to describe her as an artist. I mean, there's always in her work a sense of real catharsis. I think for many of us artists, catharsis is some like Aristotelian word that we kind of like don't completely either buy into or even expect to have happen in our shows. Mary does. I think she looks to create that in the work itself every time. She starts from there. Having her back will be really great. Treasure Island is one of my favorite books of all time. So when word got out that she was thinking about it, I called her and said, "Oh my God, you got to do Treasure Island. It's like amazing. It's like the best book ever." So, I mean, you know, come on, pirates. Who doesn't love pirates? In fact, there's been jokes around the theater that with Pirates of Penzance, we're doing kind of all pirate season. I'm really looking forward to that. I think she'll do a great job with it.
The only thing I could think is that most of her shows don't have the strong story through line of Treasure Island, though. It's different.
Well, usually she's actually facing creating the storyline. You know, like with Argonautica and you know, Notebooks of Leonardo. You're absolutely right. I mean, she's kind of cobbling together numbers of stories and trying to create overriding themes. And then usually she has a seminal sort of thematic event at the end that sort of ties it all up. This one, you're absolutely right. This has got a strong narrative line. And so I think it'll be great because I think she'll be relieved of the burden of having to, like, cobble together, you know, some sort of fantastical ending.
On the other hand, when I interviewed Richard Price, he decided to, instead of writing these long, complicated stories that involved racism, he decided to write a fast-paced bestseller. It took him 4 years, and he realized no matter what he did, he was still writing a Richard Price story.
Exactly. I mean, you know, it might be that she just ends up with the same. Maybe she'll, like, start, like, combining Treasure Island with, you know, other books by writers of that era. Who knows?
And the final show of the season is Sarah Ruhl's For Peter Pan on her 70th birthday, West Coast premiere, directed by Berkeley Rep's former associate director, Les Waters. Five siblings reconnect. That's the only information I have on it.
Well, it's a play about this family. The father passes away, and the siblings have got to figure out what they've got to figure out, what to do with his stuff. And, of course, when families gather that way, and this is the opposite in some ways of Julia's play now, is that it's a close-knit family, and they all have different takes and different histories and different experiences. What's great about it is it starts out being a play about the dad, but it ends up being a play about the kids. So the Peter Pan thing, which I don't want to give away because it's just too delicious, there ends up being this sort of fantastical event in the last scene of the play, which becomes a kind of living metaphor for the kids' experience. And when I say kids, they're like 70. They're 70 years old. So because the dad is like 95 or something like that.
Tony Taccone, as we mentioned in the introduction, you're also a director. Are you doing any directing this year?
Yeah, I can't tell you about it, though.
One final question. Head of Passes was the most recent show, and it was absolutely mind-blowing show. Is that going elsewhere now?
Yeah, Head of Passes is going to be at the Public Theater in the spring of 16. So that's very exciting. I think it deserves to be in New York and be seen by many more people. It's a deep experience, that play. I mean, it confronts the biggest questions that, you know, human existence has to offer, in a kind of seminal and both a raw and a beautiful and a rarefied way. Terrell McCraney can really write. He can really write. The cast is doing an amazing job with the performances, and so we're very proud of it.
And one final question. Now that you're opening up the Osher to Berkeley Rep shows, are you going to be doing other shows there in the future?
I hope so. I think that a space with that limited number of seats always presents economic challenges for us. You know, the budgets, it's hard to make sense out of the budgets when you can only, you know, sell a couple hundred seats a night. I mean, the run of Pirates of Penzance is like 18 months long or something because there's so few seats in the space and it's a subscription show. So it's got to run like, you know, because the only so much of our audience can see it on any given night. So it's got to run for a long time. It's a really long run. It's like 4 months. I would love to, because one of the things that's going on in the field right now is, like, as I mentioned earlier, with this interest in not only just in environmental work, but there's a lot of small companies that are doing pretty interesting work that's being called immersive, for lack of a better word. Audiences being able to kind of get closer to the performers, a little bit more of a sense of participatory experience. And you know, that's popular with younger audiences. And, you know, everyone's always interested in getting a younger audience in there. So I think the secret to the Osher space is a bar. Seriously. I think if we could sell alcohol in that place, you could make your nut, and it would bring all kinds of people in there who, you know, sailors. We don't have enough sailors in our audience. No, it's great. We could, young people like to drink. I do think that it's the only viable way to make a space like that work long term. And I'd be interested in doing that. I really would, because I do think there's more and more work that's being created by the next generation of artists that is more conducive to that kind of environment.
You've been listening to an interview with Tony Taccone, artistic director of Berkeley Rep, One Man, Two Governors, plays at the Rota through June 21st. The next show after that will be Notes from the Field, which begins on July 12th, and that's with Anna Deavere Smith. For more information, you can go to berkeleyrep.org. I'm Richard Walensky on Arts Waves, the Monday edition of Cover to Cover.